going down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest.
This is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WFT Champaign 91.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and today is Sunday, October the 6th, 2019, and this is the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, conservation, education, and whatever Dave has been up to in the last week or so.
Yeah, this week Steve Lutz came in, and he grew up in Paris, Illinois, and had a background of farming, and I was tempted to ask him a few questions about how he grew up, and we're both old enough to have grown up in the horse era, so we were exchanging thoughts. One of my concerns is that small farms losing out to corporations. That's not really good for rural sociology. It means that you condense a lot of farms that might have 80 acres or 200 acres, and the minimum that you can have now is more like 3,000 or 5,000 acres, and you have to have big equipment, and it has to go across the land so that you have small farm buildings, retired, perhaps a 5-acre lot for someone to live in, but basically a big swath of land. So that consolidation is good for finance, but it's not as always good for your ecology. So I'll read a little of what I've written here. Biodiversity is losing out to corporate zeal and not to the future of the planet. Colonialization and zeal to take over the world mostly was looking for the resources that are there, the trees or the rubber or the palm oil or whatever it has been. Not a lot of thinking about the status of what you're going into. So there's more concern about the farming for profit, than the farming with respect to the ecology. It's a little bit like medicine, where we angle towards the problem rather than knowing the personal body. So we're in an era, especially with young folk, that are thinking we should know more about what we're going into. That means we have to be looking at some of the rare resources that we have, whether they be forest or prairie or farmland or roadsides or railroad lines or park lines. So Steve and I got talking. So we've both milked a cow or driven a horse or dug potatoes or whatever. And so we're both active on this basis. And his avocation is creating bass fishing resources. So he has to know how to harvest, but they harvest in return. It's a sport. And he has to know very well the ecology of the pond from which he's taking that fish. So we started talking about horses. Grandfather had two horses. Now, if you've grown up with horses, there were various breeds. The ones that I grew up with were mostly Clydesdales. Very friendly horses, huge feet and huge muscles to work. There were also Percherons and a number of other breeds. Belgians were with one, often coming from having been bred in Europe. Those horses did a lot of the work of people. You had to break them in. There was two ways of breaking a horse in. You can get on it. If it's a riding horse, you can ride it to it's exhausted, and then you have control over it. That's kind of cruel. The better way to introduce horses to their future tasks, which they also enjoy, you take the foal and have the foal to follow you as you plow the field. You touch the foal with a sack or a blanket or something that the foal can understand. You make some friendly association with it. It might take you days to do that. If it's you want to introduce the idea of reins and long lines to connect the plowman to the horse, then you have to have a feeling for the horse. You have to have a bit that can go into its mouth in an area where there's no teeth. And you have to have a rein that has sometimes blinkers on it, because if a horse is a little frightened of things on either side, then blinkers will help that. And then you may have a yard where the horse can run around, and you can have a rope attached to its harness, and you gently suggest ways of moving, and that will be associated with that bit. So the reins have to be comfortable for the horse. If it's a draft horse, you have to have a collar. And it has to be stuffed with soft material so that a horse, when it pulls something and that collar settles down on its shoulders, will be comfortable. The collar has hames. There are two steel bars that come around and lock around the collar and hold it in place. The collar is soft enough that it would break down without the hames. And then that collar is connected to a back brace or a saddle, which goes under the belly and is tightened so that the chain that goes back to a piece of equipment will be maintained in a sort of a directional manner. The connection there will be to two swingle bars. And if you have two horses, you will have a swingle bar behind each horse, and you will have a chain that goes up on either side of the horse and eventually goes to the collar. You will have a crupper that you put under the horse's tail to hold the saddle so it doesn't ride up over its shoulders. If it's a riding horse, you can ride there on a saddle. The saddle usually has a little rise so that you can climb on the saddle and look for vegetation or whatever you're wanting. But the two chains, not too heavy chains, but strong, put together by a blacksmith. They each have a swingle bar, and then each swingle bar has another swingle bar that connects those two swingle bars. And then you have a piece of equipment. It might be a plow, and you have to have on the plow a set of holes so that you pull it. If you go to one side, it will pull into the furrow. If you go to the other side, it will pull out of the furrow a little. So you have to adjust for crossways pulling. You will have a counterpart wheel, and that wheel, or sometimes it's a piece of steel, can be lifted up or down so that you point the front of the plow into the ground or a little bit up from the ground. If you go too deep, then the horse will not be able to pull it. So there's adjustments that you make. You may walk behind a piece of equipment like a single furrow plow. You hold the reins so that you have a rein in each hand and you can adjust it. But often the horses are knowledgeable enough that they know better than you how to turn. And so when you come to the end of the furrow, you throw the plow down and it swings around, and then you have to readjust, and that's where horses can come. So there's the one horse will walk in that last furrow, and one horse will be on the new furrow. And the horses know each other's tasks, and they move together. There is a sort of bonding here, and I want to say something about bonding as we discuss these things, because bonding is a part of those small farms. And when you have huge equipment, you take away that bonding. And there is something to that. Before I leave the harness, I want to say that if you have a cart or some sort of device that you're going to load corn into or something like that, there often is a tongue which goes up and between the two horses, and it will be connected in a slightly different way without swingle bars. But all in all, you have a relationship between the farmer and the animal. If it has to be shoed, then that's very kind to the horse, because if you have a rocky farm, especially, the foot is vulnerable to damage. If you put a shoe on the foot, the hoof is like a fingernail, and you can fit the shoe to the foot, and you nail it through the fingernail, which is inert. You have to be very careful. You're looking after a frog, which is in there, which is the functional part of the hoof. In order to do this, you have to have a local blacksmith. And the local blacksmith has to be able to lift that hoof up and put it on his knee, and he has to make that horseshoe hot and malleable so that he can fit it to the fingernail. And it might take several times to do that, but it needs to be well fitted or it will fall off and cause a problem. So in order to do that, you have to have an understanding between the farmer and the blacksmith, and the blacksmith and the horse. It's interesting to see that happen. A huge set of bellows, so the blacksmith has to keep his coals afire so that he can heat that shoe up, then take it to a anvil and use various holes or shapes of the anvil to mold that shoe into place. And the holes that are in the shoe are usually there to start off with, or you create them, but they have to be in the right place to be able to nail that shoe on. So working with a horse, whether it be a riding horse or a draft horse, is quite an experience. There are little things you get to know. They love to eat while they're working. And so sometimes if you bring a bag, you can put a bag on their head and they will chew as they work. Just little things that you know where to scratch them nicely, and they're very friendly souls. Let's look at cows. Cows are also creatures that bond you. Many farmers in the Midwest had passed through an era of agriculture that was mainly livestock, but row crops were more valuable, and so farmers were had cows, but they usually had two or three cows. So Steve Lutz's grandparents had six children, and milking the cow was an event. Usually you knew your cow. You would have a bale, and the bale was like two by fours hinged at the bottom, and they had a track above the cow that had holes in it, and depending on the size of the cow, you could put a bolt in there and put the bale across behind the head so that the cow would not back off while you were milking. We very, very seldom used a bale because the cows knew what to do. We would feed them in the front with a generous helping of nutritious food. And as a result, we had heavy milk production. But it would have been the same here. You would have had, we had a maggots meal that we would add to the hay or whatever it is that we were feeding. So as a child, I would wake up early in the morning, and the cows would be in a what was a horse paddock. My father was a school teacher, and small one-teacher school teaching schools had a horse paddock or a horse field where kids that came with horses would leave their horse to roam around while they were at school. The era of coming by horse had probably gone to, I can remember some school children coming by horse, but after a while they came by bicycle or they were delivered by car. The cows would live on the commons. The commons were where livestock were moved across, this is in Australia now, were moved across the country on corridors that had a set-aside piece of land at certain locations so that cattle that were being driven were could rest overnight and move on. Those trails were fairly prominent. When I grew up, they were not being used anymore because trucks would come in. You could move cattle by truck or semi-trailer. And they were old-type trucks sometimes with hard tires. And but there was near us one such area, and it had yards for corralling pigs and weighing animals, and but it was set aside and not used very much, so monks' cows would take advantage of that set aside.
Quick question for you. So you've talked quite a few times quite a few times about how around here, every 5 miles or so, you would get a grain elevator so that everyone would have to go no more than obviously about 5 miles to be able to store their grain when they had harvested it. You can't move cows and livestock hundreds of miles. You fattened them up, and now you're going to make them walk all that. They're going to lose all of that, what you were raising them for. How far did you have, typically, would you guess, you had to take your livestock from where you raised them to where you're dropping them off?
It might be 50 miles, but you have to understand that these were corridors that were probably 100 feet wide, and they grew their own grass. And livestock people would be cluey enough that they would travel their cattle slowly. And sometimes that was mean because the one group of cattle going through would eat the vegetation on the car. But they also had these set-aside places that were where you could stop over. And it wasn't only beef cattle, or very seldom did you move dairy cattle that was away, but you would also have bullock teams, and the bullock team sometimes needed to be have a night to stay, and they also were bonded. You would find the person who would lean up against the bullock that he knew was a little shy. He would talk to his crowd. There were two types of bullockies, a little bit like working with the training of horses. You had bullockies, that's the person who was driving the team or owned the team, would talk very gently to his crowd. The other type of bullocky would be behind the team, snigging a log or something like that, and would have an 18-foot whip, and a clever driver could crack a whip just above the head of a lead a bullock, a castrated male usually, and that would be used as a symbol more than something that was cruel, but it was definitely a more definite way of training a crew. Bullock teams were important because they have hooves and they can split hooves and they can travel on mountainous roads or in mountainous terrains to take out trees more positively than a horse. So we had both. But going back to the milking of the cow, Steve knew how to lean his head into the thigh of the cow, and you put your bucket between your legs, and you learned how to milk. You took your thumb and forefinger, and then your second finger, third finger, fourth finger, and that was how you took milk out of the teat. Most neophytes didn't know to do that, so they put all their fingers together and the milk didn't come out. But the cows often knew who was new. We bought a nice roan cow from people who moved, and she was always milked by women. And so my father got ready to milk her. And that didn't really work very well, so we had to have mother come out and stand in front of the cow, and eventually father and Joey, Josephine, the cow, they bonded. But it took a little while to get used to that. So sometimes when a new person comes to milk a cow and doesn't quite know what they're doing, the cow can not give you letdown. And this is a little bit like humans. If you're sometimes encouraged to have a warm shower in order to let down milk, the the cow could sort of prevent that. The psychology was not quite right. But if you had someone that knew how to milk cows, they just sat there with a milk can, and between the knees, and you be milking with both hands. You had the possibility of putting a leg rope on, because some cows have a penchant of moving while you're being milked, and they can easily knock over your pail of milk. But we very seldom used that. But it just that getting together, feeding the cows, and providing farm lucerne, or what is called here alfalfa, to feed the cows, was a lifestyle. And that's sometimes what we miss. Even when the horses were no longer needed, grandfather got a tractor in 1951 or something like that. And so, but they kept the horses because they were part of the family. And but there were thousands and thousands of horses that actually were turned into meat because they were no longer used. So cows would have calves, and you would take the calf away after a while, because the calf couldn't go. My father had cows on the long paddock. The long paddock is the roadside. So when we went to collect the cows, we could would ask the local post person if he'd, while he was delivering mail, did he see where Monk's cows were? So we would head on a bicycle to find the cows, and they would have a pecking order. The young rambunctious heifer would be in front, and then the older cows, and down all to the last. In the meantime, the calves were on our back lawn, and we would feed them the milk from their mothers, especially the colostrum. The early milk is full of antibiotics and chemicals that make life exciting for a calf. So we'd make sure that we didn't use or abuse that sort of paradigm. They also had a sucking potential. The one way to let down milk was for a potty calf to latch onto a teat and then butt it. And that was time enough to get let down. Well, when the potty calf was separated, we had to provide some sucking potential. So you put your finger into the bucket that you were feeding them with, and so they would suck on your thumb. But if you didn't do that, they would suck on each other's ears. So if there were several calves, they would suck on each other's ears or their primitive udders. There were that real need. So getting to know your cattle, getting to know that the Holstein Friesian one that we had was kind of shy. We would make sure that we talked to it and rubbed it down. But at the meantime, the Jerseys, they're very, very friendly, would nudge under your armpit, seeking the same attention, a little bit of jealousy there. So personality is there. When it came to the male faction, that was much different. The male element of whether it's horses or cows or a lot of the animals, including chickens. A rooster can be a very domineering creature. A Jersey bull, whereas the cows are very friendly, a Jersey bull can put you up against the fence and rub its horns up and down your body without any problem at all. So you would be rather cautious. Strangely, little kids could walk right under that bull's nose and it would somehow realize that that child was a child and was gentle. But at mating time, they were dominant, and other times too, so we treated them differently. Steve had some of the same experiences. One of the things you do when you finished milking and feeding, you separate the milk. You have a centrifuge which separates the cream, and you have a handle. If you have a big separator, you have a putt-putt engine to run it, and so you have to connect up the engine and make it go. But it's very slow to start. You can only just move it. And then you're rolling. And so the cream comes out in one spout, and the separated milk comes out the other. And you can recognize this when you go to the store. You get 2% or 1% milk that has been separated. And that cream, we would put it in a pantry where it was cool and it could congeal. And if you stuck a finger and put it in, it was rather wonderful. That cream was then used for making butter. So you had to have a butter churn. And again, you were working the butter. Cream would congeal into butter, and then you would take it out, and you had a pat, and you had to move the pat to remove the moisture that was in it. Because if you didn't do that, the butter would break down because bacteria and fungi would get into it. So you added a little salt. That's why people often have a salty interest, because in early settlement times, salt and sugar were used to create an exosmosis. So you would dry out any invading bacteria and fungi. If this was especially so if you were sending butter to the home country, like England or Germany or wherever.
So you were using these things as preservatives?
Yes. But they were so common as a preservative that you would they become a national thing. So if you were drying apricots, then you used sugar. And sometimes sulfur, and people got used to these flavors, and so they feel very deprived of them when they move to a different community and a different type of preservative was moved. When I came here, I was used to Australia using salt a lot, but here it was sugar, and I really couldn't stand the amount of sugar that was in everything. But it was used as a preservative, and it's also flavorful, and it's also salt gives flavor to things.
But you're right. People to this day will still buy salted butter. I have this debate with one of my housemates. I will not buy salted butter. If I need to have salt and butter in something, I will add the salt that I need. But if you develop a taste for salted butter, you'll just keep buying that, even though you don't need it anymore as a preservative. It's going to go from the refrigerated case at the store to your refrigerator. You don't need it. It's just a taste preference. We talk about that.
So rural communities often don't have a church. They don't have a post office. They exist as they can. And eventually they do get a church, often used by different denominations, a school, a one-teacher school, and a post office. And we have a post office plug that we put in here, and that comes from the era when if you wanted to have a telephone, you went to the post office, and the secretary would put a post office plug in and join up the you to number 4 or number 6. And it would be that there would be probably 6 or 12 people on the same line. So when the phone rang, everyone picked up. And after a while, you would have to say, excuse us, but we would like to do some business, so could you all get off the phone now? So, and you would have a little phone box outside. It was like a pillbox, and your backside would stick out, and that was where you picked up the phone. We didn't have phones. We did have radio. So this was a little community, and you also had lumber, and the leftover cream that you had, you would store it in a shed that had breezeways in it so that the wind would cool the cream. And that would be twice a week it would be picked up by the cream cart. In order to do that, you had these drums, and I see them around here, that you put the cream in, and you harnessed up your horse, and you had a slide, and you put two or three drums of cream on the slide and took it down to the roadside where there was another little building where you put the drums. You had to be very careful that the slide didn't go over bumps and the whole week's cream supply would spill. But you usually had a little road to the gate. And when we were looking for our cows, we would often, if it rained, we would sit inside one of these stands where people put their cream. And also receive things. The cream cart would also be bringing you meat or vegetables or goods or equipment. So there was another industry. So at the other end of that cream cart, which was going 40 miles, there was a butter factory. And that butter factory did a commercial job of making butter. And with that butter factory, you had to know that they also had a hog butchery. And that was because when you are far enough away from a city that you can't send milk to town, you separate it, and the leftover milk is then fed to hogs. You don't feed it straight or they get diarrhea. You let it congeal like junket, and then on the second or third day you can feed it to the hogs. Well, then there's a hog industry that goes with dairying, and there's also row crops like potatoes and beans and other things that add to the biodiversity of that sort of farming. Now, we miss that a little here. We've lost a lot of that sort of home garden and home cows. And this also goes to other animals. You have goats occasionally. Goats can be tremendously friendly, almost like dogs. They follow you around. They can be also rather combative if you, they have a penchant to butt you. So if you don't bond, if you're not bonded with with a goat, you don't mess with it. Chickens are, you would think a chicken is not a friendly bonding creature, but very shortly, I was talking to someone the other day, and I asked them how their livestock was doing, and we talked back and forth, and yes, you get to know the chicken that likes to eat certain things. You get to know which is the clucky hen that is good at raising young ones. You get to know the hens that produce eggs that you can then incubate and create young chickens. Even from a very early age, they also have personalities and can bond. This is rather good for children because they, at a very early age, I had to learn how to milk cows, and my father had a hernia and had to go to hospital, and so I had to be at the age of 7 and in charge of doing all these things. We didn't have any hogs, but we did have chickens. Often, the early settlement was by river, and we've talked about that here up the Sangamon. But then you had railroads. But in our case in Australia, you had the rivers ran out to the coast. So the butter factory area not only had a hog factory, but it also usually had a shipbuilding yard, because we had plate tectonics and a little bit of volcanic soil that was very rich in amongst the very poor soil. And those rainforests were harvested for shipbuilding wood. And so you would, and some of the butter that went out from that factory went out with coastal steamers and eventually would go to other countries. I sat down and wrote about this, and I've got 18 pages here of my comments about bonding. One of the most friendly bonders is a dog. I used to work farms where the farmer had never gone on a vacation for a long time, and they trusted me to give them a break. And so I would live in the farm homestead and bond with Fido. And Fido, you would get up 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning and have a small snack and send Fido off, whatever Fido's name was, to the back 80s where the cattle were still sleeping. And so the dog would roam around and wake up the cows and bring them back home. You had to be very careful that dog didn't have a penchant for nipping the hooves of the cows, because that was not very kind. And so that dog didn't last very long. But there, by 5 o'clock, the cattle were coming into the yard for milking. And I was doing an agriculture degree, and the bales that I was working in one place were kind of grubby. And so I washed them down and cleaned them up, and not one cow would come into the bales. And so the next door neighbor, I talked to the next door neighbor, and he said, "Oh," he said, "you cleaned it up. It's not like their home." So I had to go back to having kind of a dirty floor, and cows came in without any bother at all. Looking.
8 minutes.
So in here, I want to say something about Treeley's words. This week, There's a nice article in the LAS News about working with the Big Grove, and Treeless Woods is one of those big groves. And this is where you have another situation. The early woods were harvested for trees. Often it was with oxen, and you took out the tree that you wanted, and you didn't clean cut, which is the thing that happens these days. So you left the ecologies float. There is sometimes a road through the forest. And there are stories that are word-of-mouth stories because nobody recorded them in paper, but the family knows that one family went through Brownfield Woods on a sulky, and something freaked the horse out, and it started to bolt, and the family had to decide whether they were going to throw the baby out in order to save it. Animals get to dare to do this. Kangaroos will do it. When they're chased by hunters, they will often take their young one out of their pouch and throw it into the bushes so that it will get saved, whereas they may not get saved. So just these friendly little stories are there. The settlers came and they didn't burn. So these forests are changing. Maple tends to take over because maple is very susceptible to being burned by lightning strike. But if you don't burn, then the maples can take over. So you go from oak hickory forest to a maple forest. So Treeless Woods is being censored. There's a technique for first of all, you find that Dr. Vestal, in his day in 1936, recorded all the trees in Treeless Woods, and other people did it for Brownfield Woods. And that documentation means that those woods are some of the only woods in the U.S. that have been so documented. And so it's now interesting, as climate is changing, to see if those what the changes are happening, what will happen in another 100 years to that woodlot. The archaeologists get into the act and they find out what the Indians were doing. And they would come from the protection of the land in the Vermilion County, and they would grow corn and melons and things like that. And they also got to learn that lightning improves the vegetation and improves the animals in it. And they would make a horseshoe and harvest the animals as you made a burn that had an opening where the creatures would come out and they were susceptible. But doing that is very interesting. And it goes back to what I was saying about documenting what you have rather than just burning it. I'm pleased to see that happening not only here but in Coles County and other places. The Grand Prairie Friends has 1,000 acres of mixed prairie and forest, often along the river banks. So some of the measurements that they would make would be the girth of the tree. Some of these trees are 400 and 500 years old. Sometimes there's a reluctance to drill a hole into the tree to count its rings. So a ring, if you have a very good year, will be wider, and if a poor year, it's narrower. Reading the rings of a tree give you a lot of information. There's a reluctance to do that because disease might get into that hole. You can plug it up, but it's not healthy. So you make a diameter. It might be a tree that's a meter across. You record all the trees except the little one, so it has to be about an inch across at 6 foot high. Or you now have the advantages of GIS, so you can know exactly where this tree was or is. And you have a computerization where you can make a count for missing trees or and get an overall picture of it's like big picture science using very small leftover woods. This treeless woods, I think, would be about 65 acres, and a prairie was put in beside it, and a pond was established so that mosquito researchers could do mosquito research, and a school was put in the corner. The school is now a residence, and there was an attempt to join Treeless Woods and Brownfield Woods together. It didn't quite happen. There's Phillips Track, which is part of it. But this is an area that's east of the university, and it is surprisingly natural. The Treeless Woods has a soil type that is probably prairie soil. So you have to know that the Big Grove, which was part Busey Woods, part Brownfield Woods, part Treeless Woods, was and Treeless Woods was on the edge of the prairie. So if you didn't burn, the trees moved out into the prairie. If you did burn, they went back. And the area around the Big Grove was fairly well drained because there were moraines and trees would settle there. They wouldn't like to be out in the swampland. Well, thanks for listening. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk. WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is now noon. That means it's time for Shruti, Music of India, here on WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.